From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with director Alan Arkush. Arkush has directed episodes of the TV series Moonlighting and St. Elsewhere, and did the cult film Rock and Roll High School. Also today, I talk with performance artist Eric Bogosian. He now has the hit off-Broadway play Talk Radio about a malevolent call-in talk show host. Folk singer Michael Cooney revives a couple of old love songs, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the new play Psycho Beach Party, an off-Broadway spoof of Beach Party movies. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Arkush. He's one of a new breed of Hollywood directors who crosses back and forth between film, television, and videos. His TV credits include St. Elsewhere, L.A. Law, Bronx Zoo, Fame, and Moonlighting. He directed the episode of Moonlighting where the Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis characters finally make love. And he directed the episode of St. Elsewhere where Dr. Craig attempts to write his memoirs in several different genres. Arkush also directed the cult film Rock and Roll High School, which starred the punk band The Ramones, and he did the rock film Get Crazy. Those rock credits led him into directing rock videos, including Beast of Burden with Mick Jagger and Bette Midler. Alan Arkush studied film with Martin Scorsese at the New York University Film School. He got his start working for producer Roger Corman on his low-budget exploitation movies. We invited Alan Arkush to speak with us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. I asked him why he first made the switch from directing movies to TV.
In a certain way, the movie business decided that it had enough of me. I had made a couple of movies. The most successful was probably Rock and Roll High School, and that was a success only in the sense that it was on midnight showings in theaters. Then I made Heartbeats, which did very poorly at the box office, and then I did a movie called Get Crazy, which had real distribution problems and was hardly run at all. And at that point, it was extremely difficult for me to get to do another movie. And I had been tagged by the movie business as someone who, in their mind, did only midnight movies, very strange movies. And thus, the only things I got sent were more of that, but even weirder. Also, I found that the scripts on television were much, much better than the scripts in movies.
In what ways?
I think that they're more adult. I think that they investigate the nuances of characters more. And I think that they're written with much more craft and technique. They don't do things in the most obvious, straightforward manner. They find new ways to do scenes. I always kid Glenn Caron, who writes Moonlighting, and say, Glenn, this is a billiard scene, and that's sort of a code we have. A billiard scene is a scene where instead of trying to get the point to the scene by hitting it, the eight ball directly into the corner pocket, Glenn will write it so he does three cushions and then into the corner pocket. It's a way of doing something to make it more interesting. We're getting there is as much fun as being there.
Can you think of an example of that kind of...
The scene in Moonlighting where the show where Bruce and his father have a falling out because Bruce has slept with his father's bride-to-be. For the whole shooting of that episode, it pointed to the big scene where Bruce confronts the woman and says, "Don't you remember when we slept together?" And we all thought it was going to be a four-page scene where they confront it, and Bruce realizes during the conversation that she has no idea who he is. And we figured 4 pages, we'll do the scene, no problem. The day before we're supposed to do the scene, it's now 11 pages long and features children of all nations singing It's a Small World. That's what I call doing it the hard way. And it built to this whole climax where the whole key line to the show is, wouldn't it be funny if we had slept together? And Bruce sort of supposed to say, yeah, wouldn't it? And he realizes that Mr. Macho made no impression at all on this woman, and his father, who he always thought of as being less sensitive than him, had. And the whole scene goes back and forth, and it's a wonderful scene. The actress gave a terrific performance, and this line is thrown away at the end of the scene. The whole point of the show, the punchline, is sort of done as a throwaway, because it's after the big emotional peak. And I directed it that way, and it worked perfectly. People really remember that moment.
Some people say that television is getting more adventurous as the movies are getting more formulaic. Do you think that's true?
oh, the things I've done on television are so much more far out than the things I've done on movies. We did a whole episode of Fame, which was a tribute to Sherlock Holmes, and we had the camera tilted, and we did shot part of it in black and white. I've done a ballet on Fame using traditional moves you see in Western movies and homages to Western music, where everything is done in black and white, and we take the mannerisms of a gunfight and turn them into a dance. The first episode of Moonlighting for next year is going to completely blow everyone's mind. It is, what we've done is so original, I can't give it away. But when you tune in, it's going to be a real surprise. It's one of those things that only Moonlighting can do. I've done things on St. Elsewhere where the dream sequences within dreams, within dreams. We've talked about topics that are far more serious and more important than you see in most movies today.
Ellen, you got your training at NYU Film School, and I know you studied with Martin Scorsese, who's since become one of America's leading directors. You credit him with having excited you about American films. Why were you overlooking American films at the beginning of your film school career?
There's an irony to that in the sense that I was brought up loving all American movies. You know, I went and saw Cowboy Pictures. I went and saw Rio Bravo. And I saw Shane, and I saw Lawrence of Arabia, and I saw lots of movies when I grew up. And when I got into high school, there's a certain snobism steps in. You start seeing foreign pictures. Then when you get to film school, everyone's watching foreign pictures because they are thought of as the more serious movies. And I started seeing Godard movies and Truffaut and Renoir, and I was really very much excited by all these foreign pictures. The American movies had sort of slipped to the background for me because also as a, and I put this in quotes, young intellectual in high school, I tended to look at things which were a little bit different and tried to seek out those things that were different. And so I was skipping school to go down to the Bleecker Street Cinema to see 8 and a half. Then in film school, there was also more access to these foreign pictures. And as time went on, I was interested in them and more in them. And I started seeing almost those movies exclusively, except the old movies that I saw on TV. Then in Marty's class, he started talking about all these directors, and I realized that Rio Bravo was directed by the great Howard Hawks, and that Shane was directed by George Stevens. So it was like all these movies that I'd loved as a kid, I now was able to validate intellectually because I started seeing more and more movies by Hawks and George Stevens and other people. So it sort of took me full circle, in that I was able to appreciate what I had liked as a child in innocence, I was able to appreciate intellectually as an adult.
You started to learn the craft of directing, doing films for Roger Corman, who's the king of B-movies, the king of schlock in a lot of ways. You started off doing trailers for his movies. What were some of the tricks you learned about how to sell a movie through a trailer?
Well, Roger was really interested in basically selling sex and violence. That was what we made each trailer point towards. So we would be doing trailers for movies like Big Bad Mama, TNT Jackson, Eat My Dust, Grand Theft Auto, Caged Heat. And a lot of these are directed by people who, Jonathan Demme, Jonathan Kaplan, Paul Bartel, that went on and directed lots of other movies. So we were all cutting these pictures. In the meantime, Roger was going off and buying foreign pictures. And at one point, he bought a picture by Fellini called Amarcord. And he called us to come down to the screening room, and we watched Amarcord. And it's a great movie. And we were awestruck by how good it was. And here we had just finished the trailer for TNT Jackson, She'll Put You in Traction. And now we were starting the trailer for Fellini's Amarcord. And at the end of the movie, Roger says, I want you to sell the same things we always sell, sex and violence. It's always true. People like it, whether it's in Italian or it's in English. So we cut together a trailer, and it ran about 4 minutes long. We showed it to Roger, and we used the race car scenes from Amarcord and all the sexy shots of the women, and we used lots of pranks that the kids used. And it was a long trailer. Roger really liked it, and we sent it out to the theaters, and it was the biggest opening any Fellini movie had ever had. So there's a message in there somewhere. I mean, the fact that Roger Corman used to double bill Cries and Whispers with women in cages is a very bizarre concept, but a lot of people got to see Cries and Whispers. So in a sense, I learned how to sell a movie to a certain style of ad campaign. But by breaking movies down into their essential elements that made people want to come see them, I was able to really grasp how those elements were handled best, the best way to shoot a car crash scene after seeing so many action scenes, and how to condense thoughts down to their most cinematic and most powerful moments.
Now, I think Hollywood Boulevard, you did on a bet with Roger Corman, you bet him what, that you could make a movie cheaper than any movie he'd ever made?
And with more action in it. That was
making
a movie cheaper was no trick to him. He just wouldn't have let us have any more money. But making it with more action in it, that was a challenge. So what we did was we took all these action scenes that we had seen over and over during the last 2 years, and we took them out of their original movies. And you got to understand, these are Filipino war movies. These are women in prison movies. These are car chase movies, science fiction movies. And we designed the plot around it about murders on a movie set. And we went out into Malibu and we gave our actresses machine guns and they fired them right to left or left to right. And then we would cut to people falling out of trees right to left or left to right in these Filipino war movies. And that was how we shot all our action scenes. We never shot the action part. We only shot the reactions and the little bits that instigated the action.
He must have been real proud of you.
And we cut it all together, and it came out, it cost $75,000, and it went on to make, I guess, about $1.5 million for Roger. I got paid $85 for directing the whole picture.
That's part of the reason why it was so cheap, right?
Oh, you bet. The costume budget was $250. The entire movie was made on short ends. It's a funny movie. When it's on cable now and I look at it, it's like it's a movie from another planet. It makes no sense whatsoever. People seem to like it because it's so surreal.
I bet one of the things that you learn when you work with Roger Corman is how to not be sanctimonious about movies.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, you can see a trend in my own thinking about movies going from slight teenage pretentiousness for foreign films to the reality of getting a job and making a movie and not taking what you do too seriously. There's nothing worse than a self-serious exploitation movie. You know, it just doesn't come off right, especially when you're trying to do a comedy. And when I made Rock and Roll High School, it was a conscious effort to not try and make a serious movie about teenagers who are disenfranchised from their high school. It just wasn't what we were trying to do.
Well, I've seen Rock and Roll High School, and it's set in a high school. The Ramones star in it. And it really reminded me of a lot of the rock and roll pictures from the early 60s where, you know, the PTA does the Froog at the end of the movie.
Exactly. Like the plot of Rock, Rock, Rock. I think it's Rock, Rock, Rock. Lot of the inspiration was taken from those movies. I was trying to do a genre movie. I was trying to do a high school musical about how rock and roll is bad for you, and really focusing on punk music. The whole inspiration for it was my own high school experiences. In fact, many of the scenes in the movie were scenes I'd thought of in high school.
Such as?
Instead of the Ramones coming down the high school hallway playing, when I was in high school, I daydreamed that it was the Yardbirds. And I'd also daydream that we blew up the high school and that we had motorcycle races around the hallways. These are all things that I'd kept with me for years, and thus when I got to make the movie and I put them into the movie, there's a lot of truth to it in that it comes from a basic, strong emotion. And I think that's one of the reasons people respond so well to Rock and Roll High School, and that we've all been really frustrated by high school. Also, the Ramones just seemed like to be aliens from another world, and I wanted to do something about how music sort of fosters your fantasy life. And then one of the reasons we listen to music is to take us away from what our daily lives are like. And so I picked a group who I like, the Ramones, who are as different from the Southern California high school girls that the movie was about as possible. Also, they're a very unpretentious band.
Yeah, I'll say. Alan, let's talk again about working in television. You told us earlier about why you crossed over from movies to TV. You've done so many different TV shows. Do you get a style book when you're entering a TV show that's already in progress?
In a certain sense, if you do, in that there's a very strong look to each show that's a good show, and we're only talking about the really good ones. The ones, in a sense, on television, the auteur is the executive producer. And the executive producer sets a look and a style of acting and a subject matter. And when you if you want to do your job properly when you go from show to show, you really have to study the style of what they're after. In the case of St. Elsewhere, it was very easy for me since I had been a fan of the show. And one of the reasons I wanted to do the show is that I liked the way it was shot. I liked the handheld look and the mobility and the fact that scenes are long, unbroken takes. And I liked the way that the comedy is a very black humor and the way that it works so well with the dramatic storylines. Moonlighting, on the other hand, is completely opposite. Moonlighting is all long lenses, it's all portrait lighting, it's very much like an old Hollywood movie. We try to imitate the look of many movies from the 40s. And it's not as mobile, and it's since it's two characters, it's more cut back and forth, close-up to close-up, in the sense of, and also it's not an ensemble show. So much of our work takes place in either the moonlighting agency or in Maddie's house or at David's apartment or else in the car. St. Elsewhere takes place in a hospital, moving from room to room and operating rooms. So if you're going to do your job well, you really have to learn the styles. And in doing that, you pick up a lot of things that you wouldn't normally try. That's the great thing about television. You can try something and see it on the air 3 or 4 weeks later and say, well, that worked or that didn't work. And it's not like your career depends on it the way it is with a movie where it's 2 years of anticipation and it comes out and it has such a short shelf life. It plays for a week or two or maybe, you know, if it's a hit, 2 or 3 months, and then it's gone.
No, the way you're describing it, it's reminding me of the days of the old Hollywood studios when directors would get lots and lots of films to do, and they would churn it out, and some of the films would be great, and some of them wouldn't be, but there'd be a lot of work.
Yes, and in a lot of ways, this is like that. It is going from Moonlighting to St. Elsewhere to L.A. Law. It's like going from one genre to another genre, and it's fun to do. This year, I'm going to basically concentrate on Moonlighting since it's been so successful for me. And I really love the show and I love the characters. And I think we're onto something really exciting now with the new relationship between Maddie and David and what's going on with them. Then I'm going to stay with them. When you move around from show to show, when you first sort of come in, it's a bit like being the substitute teacher in school. Everyone wants to see how much they can get away with. And then once you've done a couple of shows, they get used to you, they know what you do. It becomes a more comfortable working arrangement.
Alan, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back. My guest is Alan Arkush, who directs for television and the movies. He's speaking to us from Los Angeles. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Alan Arkush, who has directed for movies and TV. On television, he's directed episodes of Fame, Moonlighting, and St. Elsewhere. His film credits include Get Crazy and Rock and Roll High School. You directed the first show where the Sybil Shepherd and Bruce Willis characters have sex on Moonlighting. And I was wondering if there was a lot of discussion that you were in on about whether this was a good idea or not. You know, whether they should have sex in the series or not.
There was endless discussion on this topic. It's one of the main things that's discussed about the show in general. And finally, when Glenn Caron made the decision to do that, he really wanted to have a storyline based a lot about around Sybil, because Bruce carries a lot of the more comedic shows around Sybil and what would happen if a man really fell for Maddie Hayes. And that's where the Mark Harmon character came from. And working it over the course of 4 episodes really got us a lot of time to work out all the different permutations and all the different things that could happen between 3 people. So when the decision was made to actually do the love scene, we were pretty sure that was absolutely the right thing to do. And we'd also run out of ways to not have the love scene.
You play that last episode for lust and also for sight gags. The Bruce Willis character was knocking over all the furniture, all the tchotchkes and vases in the living room as they were passionately going about making love. Well, they're both very self-conscious during that scene, because after all, this is the first time their characters did this together. It was a real high point in the series.
That was one of the most difficult episodes, difficult hours of anything I've ever directed. Aside from the fact that here had been building for 2.5 years, and if it wasn't a great love scene, well, you know, it just wasn't going to be up to what everyone's expectations were. And we had the problem that Sybil was pregnant with twins, is pregnant with twins, and the fact that during the shooting of that episode, Bruce Willis had a skiing accident and broke his collarbone, and Mark Harmon had to leave because he had was on the contract for a limited amount of time, had to leave partially through the shooting of the episode. So a lot of it is done with doubles, and the big love scene, because Bruce and Sybil were so physically uncomfortable, Bruce because of his collarbone and her because of her pregnancy, was done, the stuff on the floor was done with doubles, and the two of them in bed and rolling around on the floor was actually done with them standing up. And we took the carpet and mounted it on a platform of wood. They stood there, and we aimed the camera above them so it looked like it was shooting down on them on the floor.
Sex isn't what it used to be.
No, it isn't. And there was a lot of discussion as to how passionate they'd be, and there was a lot of discussion about when they call each other bitch and bastard. And also a lot of discussion as to how to make it seem that it was mutual, that it wasn't one person having a conquest over the other.
So are you pleased with the way it worked out?
I'm very pleased, and I couldn't be happier with the choice of music, since Be My Baby is one of my favorite songs, one of the greatest rock songs of all time. I like the way the show came out, and the editors kept telling me, this is going to be a good one, this is going to be a good one, and then when I saw it all cut together on the air, and I found that the next day that 60 million people had seen it also, I was pretty pleased.
What happened with Moonlighting this year? It seems that there were very few new episodes, and some of the new episodes didn't arrive on time. They were late by several weeks.
Oh, we just never are on time. We're not even close to being on time. We sort of proceed at our own pace and try to get out as much new stuff as possible. But it takes 3 weeks to do an episode of Moonlighting, at least. And now that Sybil's pregnant, it can take as long as 5 weeks because it's very difficult for her to work a full shooting day. So that when the show's supposed to be on every week, that's a real math problem is presented. And it's just the nature of the way we do the show. There's a philosophy there that we don't want to do a show on schedule just to do it on schedule. We'd rather give the audience something that's special. And I think it shows up on the screen and certainly hasn't hurt the popularity of the show.
You've done several programs for Moonlighting and St. Elsewhere where there's film parodies going on or literary parodies. And I wonder if you think of yourself as part of a new breed of director in television. And what I'm referring to is people who are passionate about movies, not just television, and who bring in all kinds of film references and film parodies as well into TV shows.
Well, when you get to work as much as I do, you really get to draw on all your knowledge. And one of the things that we try and do is use as much film techniques as possible and not just settle for the most efficient way to shoot a scene. There's ways to shoot scenes, you know, where you get the crew out early or you get the show done on schedule, but it's not as interesting. In the case of Moonlighting, for instance, the cameraman and I talk all the time about what each scene will look like, and we make a very conscious effort to capture a look. In the show where Mark Harmon proposes to Sybil Shepherd, and she's standing near her couch, and it's the middle of the night, and he's offered to make her lamb, the light across her face, cameraman's setting up the shot, and I look at it, and I said, Marlena Dietrich? And he said, no, Joan Crawford. And it was a conscious effort to do a specific style of lighting. Sometimes when we do our daylight scenes, we try to get an ominous overtone to them on Moonlighting, and the daylight scenes in the office or else in Maddie's house, and we'll try and emulate, say, an RKO movie from the mid-40s. And that's a common language. It's a common reference to people who know film history. So it's a way of shortcutting and getting to that look. I also love to do replicate sequences. There's all kinds of problems in shooting a scene, and sometimes you'll remember a scene from a movie that's like what you're doing, and you'll go back and look at it and see how the various problems were solved by a great director or a great cameraman. And I really try to keep my style changing and keep learning things. So I'm constantly watching movies. I watch 250, 300 movies a year. I watch movies all the time, so I try to use as much of that in my work as possible and take the good things out of classical movie making. Also, this is an age of sort of postmodernism and modernism in general, where art makes references to itself. You see it in paintings, you see it now a lot in television, and you see it definitely in movies. So there's in Moonlighting, for instance, when Bruce turns to the camera and winks, that's what I call a modernist point of view. There's an irony there. And we use it whenever we feel the plot is going in the most obvious place. It's like time to let the audience know that we're just going through the motions here so we can continue our story.
Do you run into a lot of people who you don't know, and when you introduce yourself, they know your name, but they can't quite place it?
Yes, it happens a lot, because on television, your name's on the screen for about 2 seconds. And then they say, what do you do? And you say, well, you direct this show or that show. And then you say, what episodes? And people really remember the episodes. When I say I directed the episode where the woman becomes a chalkaholic on St. Elsewhere, everyone remembers her, you know, with the pastry gun in her mouth, trying to commit suicide by chocolate. The Moonlighting episode about Bruce and his father. There are certain episodes I've done that seem to stand out, and they're distinctive enough so that people remember them.
Are your friends more impressed by the fact that you've done movies or television?
It's really a hard question, because
your friends all work in movies and television.
Yeah, it depends, you know. If they like, some of my friends love some of my movies, and some of my friends don't like some of my TV series because they just don't like the characters or the shows. I find that when you leave Hollywood and you're out there in the rest of the country, people are probably more impressed that you do television. They're really, really impressed that you do Moonlighting, and they love those shows. People look forward very strongly to having, you know, Maddie and David in their living room, or the cast of St. Elsewhere or L.A. Law at home and watching their exploits every week. And I wasn't until I started doing more and more television that I realized how powerful that is, that it's really something to be able to communicate to that many people on a weekly basis and have the room to cake them all places with a character that you wouldn't normally get to if you were just doing a movie and dropping the character after 95 minutes.
There was a time when doing television was seen as a step down from doing film, and I think once you were doing TV, you were kind of out of the film world. Now, you're about to do another movie, a National Lampoon movie. Is it no longer true that doing television is looked down on by people in films?
I think doing the good television shows is definitely thought of very highly. I think anyone who's able to do the shows that I do and that the other directors do these shows are top-notch directors. I go to the movies all the time, and I'll tell you, there's no status to doing a bad movie. And directors like Mark Tinker, who directs St. Elsewhere, or Peter Werner, who's directed a lot of Moonlighting, these people are world-class directors. And if they were doing feature films, they would be doing the important feature films. It's just that they're choosing, in a lot of cases, to produce and direct, you know, TV shows. So I think people move back and forth. And it's certainly, there's been a lot more interest in me and in me directing movies since I've been directing these key shows. People are able to see my work and see the variety of things that I can do. They don't just think of me as the guy who did Rock and Roll High School now. They realize I can do dramatic stuff and I can do romantic comedies.
Alan Arkush, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been director Alan Arkush. His credits include the TV series Moonlighting, L.A. Law, and St. Elsewhere, and the film Rock and Roll High School. He's currently directing the new National Lampoon movie, College Bound. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'm going on vacation for 2 weeks. While I'm gone, Leanne Hansen will host Fresh Air. Leanne is, among other things, a former co-host of Weekend All Things Considered. On the next Fresh Air, she'll speak with Tracy Ullman, the British comedian, actress, and singer who is now starring in her own American TV show. So I hope you can tune in. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶ From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, performance artist Eric Bogosian talks about his explorations of the dark side of American culture. Bogosian wrote and stars in the play Talk Radio, and his work will be featured on public television's Alive from Off Center. Also, folk singer Michael Cooney performs some forgotten love songs, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Psycho Beach Party. The man who wrote the play performs in drag as the leading lady. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. We've invited Michael Cooney back to join us for our weekly performance spot. Cooney is best known as a collector of folk songs and ballads, but he also has great affection for pop love songs.
Here's a pair of love songs. There are a lot of songs in the world today that purport to be about love, but they seem to be mostly about, oh, baby, 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 set my soul on fire. Oh, baby, 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 you're my heart's desire. Oh, baby, could you hold that mirror just a little higher? Here's a couple of songs from long ago that say it a little more cleverly, I think. Does your mother know you're out, Cecilia? Does she know that I'm about to steal ya? Oh my, when I look in your eyes, something tells me you and I should get together. How's about a little kiss, Cecilia? Just a kiss, you'll never miss, Cecilia. Why do we two keep on wasting time? Oh, Cecilia, come on and say you'll be mine. Does your mother know you're out, Cecilia? Does she know that I'm about to steal ya? Oh my, when I look in your eyes, something tells me you and I should get together. How's about a little kiss, Cecilia? Just a kiss, you'll never miss, Cecilia. Why do we two keep on wasting time? Oh, Cecilia, come on and say you'll be mine. Wasn't that nice? This is nice. I'd like to have a movie set for this. Bring up the movie set. There is no verse to this song, 'cause I don't want to wait a moment too long. to say that I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all your lovers weeping on a faraway shore, out on the briny with that moon big and shiny, melting your heart of stone. Honey, I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. A twist in the rudder and a rip in the sails, drifting and dreaming, throw the compass over the rail. Out on the ocean, far from all the commotion, melting your heart of stone. Honey, I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself with nobody else, all to myself alone.
Michael Cooney is based in Richmond, Indiana. He writes a regular column for the folk song magazine Sing Out. Fresh air. My guest is Eric Bogosian. For the past 10 years, he's been performing his one-man shows, featuring his characterizations of people who epitomize the American dream gone bad. He began performing in Manhattan lofts and alternative spaces, but last year successfully moved to an uptown legitimate theater with his show Drinking in America. In that show, he assumed more than a dozen roles, from a Bowery bum to a manic Hollywood agent. Excerpts from another show, Funhouse, will be on public television's next edition of Alive from Off-Center. Here's a sample of two characters he created for Funhouse, a fast-talking telephone insurance salesman and a wino.
I know you're having dinner right now, Mr. Stearns, but this is very important. Now, Mr. Stearns, I've seen it time and time again. Husband dies, wife's left with no pension, no life insurance, she has a mortgage to pay off. You know, of course, Mr. Stearns, most women in this country outlive their husbands. What happens then, Mr. Stearns? Have you thought about that? I'll be honest with you, Mr. Stearns. This is a very, very perverse and disturbed world we live in these days. Now, I could take you up to 42nd Street, and I could show you some little girls, 14-year-old girls, standing on the corner. What's that? Well, it wouldn't cost you very much at all, Mr. Stearns. I'd say around $250,000 worth to do it. Uh-huh. Sure, sure. Now, I'll be here all day tomorrow. How about that? Why don't you come by in the morning? Okay? All right.
Hey, buddy. Hey, buddy, could you help a guy up for a second here? I just slipped and fell down. I was running the marathon here, buddy, and I fell down for a second. How about it? What do you say? Huh? Hey, buddy, I'm talking to you. What do you think? I'm talking to the fire hydrant here or something? How about it? Give me a hand, huh? Huh? You, the guy with the New York Times on the air. What's the matter? Can't you help out a guy for 2 seconds, huh? Well, you gotta rush home and skim the pool, huh? Uh-huh. Drive the wife to the Amnesty International meeting? Is that what you gotta do? You can't help me out here for 2 seconds? How about it? What do you say, huh? Huh? I know you can hear me.
Eric Bogosian has created a new character for his play Talk Radio. He plays Barry Champlain, an abrasive late-night local talk show host who bullies and insults his callers. Bogosian came to New York in the early 70s to act in the theater, but he was attracted to the freewheeling Soho art scene. When I spoke to Eric Bogosian, he told me that his friendships with artists like Cindy Sherman and Robert Longo led him to believe that he could apply their artistic independence to his own performances.
When I started making performance art, it was although I never called it that, it had a strong theatrical bent to it, which at first had a lot of people very upset with me that I was introducing dramatic elements to performance art. You're not supposed to do that. But that's a quote, you're not supposed to do that. But I always felt that the whole idea of performance art was that you can do whatever you want to do. And as soon as people started telling me what I was supposed to do and not supposed to do in that scene, I thought, well, they're hypocrites.
Discouraging when even the avant-garde has rules.
Right, right. It doesn't make sense.
One of the first characters, I think, that you created was a malevolent comic named Ricky Paul. Would you describe him?
Ricky's a guy who had a lot of real bad intentions, but there was something about him that was, he was kind of a fool. And since he was a fool but malevolent at the same time, the audience was allowed to get near him. Some people still hated him. The whole way I did the show was to be as disturbing as possible. He sang songs off key. He taunted the audience. He told jokes that were in very bad taste. For instance, he was talking about women's liberation. And he said, I went by the Women's Liberation offices the other day down the street. They had a big sign out front. It said, Free Women. I went in and I asked them if they delivered. And this was just awful stuff. And that's just the light stuff that he did. I can't really say over the air what some of his really nasty stuff was. But it was a piece. It was an idea that, you know, let's get all real involved here. Let's see how we really feel about these things. Because clearly, although the avant-garde, or whatever you want to call the downtown scene, likes to see itself as this incredibly fringe group of people, they are in fact incredibly middle class, and they love to carry ideas and never really examine them. And I think it's fine to say that you're not sexist and you're not racist and you're not homophobic, but it's actually not true for most people who are part of this scene. Ricky would take on the role of sort of the devil inside of all of us.
You started creating a whole gallery of characters whose persona you would take on. What do you look for in a character that you're going to create? Are you looking for some prototype?
First of all, I was just looking for stereotypes. I was, when I made the first show, I made it from the point of view that we carry stereotypes around within us, sort of always, we have them in mind, but we don't really think them out loud. For instance, if I said wino to you or bum, an image would come to mind. Where that image comes from is a combination of real winos and bums that you've seen in your life, and also ones you've seen in movies or television. I always start with the idea that the people that I play are people that you know right away, because I think they kind of come from the little world of people that we carry around inside of us, collectively.
Your new show, Talk Radio, is about a two-way talk radio host, someone who spends most of their time taking phone calls from listeners and hanging up on them, insulting them. Mm-hmm. What intrigued you about that kind of character? Can you listen to that kind of radio?
I'm actually not that big a fan of it. My partner on the show, Tad Savinar, is a visual artist in Portland, Oregon. He had met me while I was on tour, and he came to me with the idea that I play a guy like this because I had always played so many different people. He said, well, why don't you play one person and react to a number of people? If you play a character who's sort of a chameleon and changes his manner with each person who calls, that would be interesting. I ended up creating Barry and his particular style, which is very combative, because I thought that it wouldn't be very interesting to watch a mellow radio announcer on stage. I had to have a guy that was just popping out of his chair.
One of the things that interests me in those kinds of characters is how they insult people who apparently keep coming back for more.
Mm-hmm.
People call up and they know they're going to be insulted. And I always wonder why they'd call if they think, well, maybe they'll be different. Maybe they're the one caller on the face of the earth who this talk show host is going to think is really brilliant.
I don't know
why they do it.
Yeah, it's also the power of the media. I mean, why do people go on quiz shows and act like idiots? I think for people out there who have never been on a radio show or a TV show, it's like magic. It's unbelievable. They think that if they can lock into that energy, they're going to be transformed. And all you have to do is pick up your phone and dial the talk show's number, and you're on the air. It's like when you see a guy that you've seen on TV walking down the street, and you almost can't believe it that he's, you know, gee, that's Jack Klugman. You know, how did he get out of the TV set? He's actually walking around on the street. and it's like he's like more than human. He's something else. And in fact, he's just an actor.
You know, I'm realizing listening to you now that this is, I think, the first time I've heard you talk as yourself. I've heard you do a lot of different characters, and you seem to find a different voice and a different way of speaking for each of them. And it's interesting to hear your mm-hmm. own voice now.
This isn't really my own voice. This is my radio voice.
You're doing an act now as the guy who's being interviewed on the radio.
Yeah.
What I admire so much about your voice is that you're able to do like a perfect insurance salesman, yet you're also able to do a perfect psychotic murderer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the question is.
Well, I've been blessed with a couple of things that that have allowed me to make up a game that I play by my own rules. I mean, I've made up a kind of way of performing that that uses the things that I was born with and I'm good at. I mean, there's some things I'm terrible at, and but this voice, I don't know where it came from. It has a lot of range, and I can play around with it. You know, I come from acting school where they tell you that you can't do an accent unless you do it absolutely perfectly. And all my accents are, in fact, not perfect. They're all wrong, but they're the way they sound to me, and they sound right to the audience, so I get away with it.
Eric Bogosian, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eric Bogosian performs on the next edition of Public Television's Alive from Off Center. His new play, Talk Radio, is being made into a film. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Our top story today is on the meeting of Central American presidents in Guatemala City, which ends today. The Central American leaders had gathered there to try and come up with a peace plan for the region acceptable to all. Also, teens stuck in the 60s. Now, that might sound like 60s music, but it's not. It's a new tune popular with teens today. They're also dusting off old psychedelic artifacts of the 60s, first acquired by their parents.
And you'll be covering that tonight?
We will.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, has a review of Psycho Beach Party, a play currently running off-Broadway in which the leading lady is a man.
Psycho Beach Party, starring Charles Bush and his superb Theater in Limbo company, is a peachy play. Bush is a drag performer. He's not well known outside New York, but he will be, because his work is deliciously entertaining and super smart. Psycho Beach Party, which is a spoof of early 60s surfing movies, dismantles the craziness of the age while letting us enjoy our nostalgia for it. Remember Gidget? Don't lie. Bush plays Chicklet, a skinny girl who wants to surf. But beneath the surface of this innocent creature and seemingly simple era lurk psychosexual beasts that can devour Cleveland in one bite. Chicklet's mom starts off talking like Donna Reed, but soon reveals herself a full Claude Faye Dunaway as Joan Crawford. And from the depths of Chicklet rises alter ego Anne Bowman, dominatrix empress of the world. She wreaks havoc on the denizens of Malibu, including a pair of budding gay men and a Marilyn Monroe-type iron butterfly. But at the end, Starcat, a psychiatrist in training turned beach bum, conducts a wham-bam 5-minute psychoanalysis, and the parts of Chicklet are reunited. The majority of drag performers are conservative about sex roles and jeering towards women. The London performer Danny LaRue wears gobs of makeup and intricate binding costumes. For him, femininity has to be achieved like Mount Everest, and he reassures his audience that men and women are nothing alike. Working in another tradition, Charles Pierce dresses up like the divas Crawford, Davis, and Garland, but he doesn't like these women. They represent his sissy, damaged self, for instead of playing up their strengths, he burrows into their egotism, loneliness, and self-abuse. This kind of drag is about slumming in femininity, a place like Lower East Bitch. Charles Bush, on the other hand, plays feisty feminists, and his portrayals are always affectionate. He not only enjoys the femme part of himself, he sees it as admirable, emotionally expressive, receptive, and seductive. Unlike LaRue and Pierce, Bush's drag doesn't disguise that he's a man. His costumes don't soften his gawky boy's body, and he doesn't pad his flat chest. On occasion, he even bares it. In Bush's art, to go from boy to girl or girl to boy is not an arduous climb or a decadent fall, but a pass through a door inside the self. He does miss a chance to stir our psyches, though, by not casting women as studs. Granted, to generate excitement, Western women can't just put on men's clothes, because decades ago they appropriated them for daily wear. Women have to wear facial hair, chest hair, and a stuffed jock, as Lily Tomlin does playing Tommy Velour. Still, so long as maleness is deemed superior to femaleness, the notion of a woman wishing to be a man will never seem as perverse as a man wishing to be a woman. Charles Bush lets go of the masculine without fear of castration. His art has passed through anxiety. He can imagine anything without despising himself and without minimizing the scariness of fantasizing. I like acting girlish, womanly, and vixenish, his persona says. Who doesn't sometimes? His plunge into otherness invites the audience to indulge in their fantasies. He symbolizes the forbidden leap for everybody, whether it's a man wanting his female lover to stage all the parts of a sexual scene, or that woman wanting to take control, or a lesbian wanting to take a vacation in high heels and a dress.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a preview of our next program. Next time, we'll hear from H.F. Saint, author of the novel Memoirs of an Invisible Man. The main character, a mediocre stock analyst, gives new meaning to the term insider trading. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis will review an album featuring singer Big Joe Turner, the one-time Kansas City bartender whose booming delivery fused jazz and pop. And guest television critic David Mark will offer his thoughts on the current popularity of 50 sitcoms like Father Knows Best. So I hope you can join us. I'll be on vacation for the next 2 weeks, and Leanne Hansen will host Fresh Air. You may remember Leanne as a former co-host of Weekend All Things Considered. So I'll see you again in a couple of weeks. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.